Welcome back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Folks, during our last segment, we had a pretty powerful and passionate conversation based upon Frederick Douglass's question, what to the slave is your 4th of July? We had a lot of people calling in with their comments. I want to wrap that conversation up because I think you're going to enjoy the direction we're moving in. But we had one last caller, Tara from Baltimore, who wanted to get in on that conversation from the last segment. Let me go ahead and take that caller before I switch topics. Tara, how are you?
Hi, Dr. K. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for calling.
This is my first time calling.
We are you? Well, welcome to the family.
Yes, thank you. I just want to say I really, really love you, and I appreciate everything that you just bring forth to the community.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to make a quick comment to the last caller, the Caucasian guest that called in talking about how, you know, the young black men should pull up their pants and do this and do that. And I just wanted to say, just because, you know, your partner is African-American, you don't really have a place to tell us what we should do. I mean, don't persecute us, you know. Get out and help us. Get out and support. And I just want to say that we're doing the best we can, okay? Just because what you see on the outside isn't what you should make up in your mind. So
I'm so glad you said that, Tara. I appreciate you.
I definitely appreciate you.
Thank you for calling. Folks, when we start talking about respectability politics in the black community, like, we can go down that road, because I think all of us are aware that black folks were lynched whether they were wearing a three-piece suit or jeans hanging down. We were lynched whether we were in a dress or shorts. Our clothes do not determine who we are. But it's interesting to think that one of the things that folks feel comfortable saying, pull your pants up, as if pulling our pants up will restore the dignity that we've lost in this society. It does not. Now, that is a great segue into our next topic. I want to talk about the three strikes rule and the way that it has severely gutted and impacted the black community, and the ways that we're trying to do some restorative justice in that area. I'm joined this hour by Albert Reed Jr. Now, he has a story, folks. Albert Reed Jr. went to prison at the age of 24 and served 25 years of a federal life sentence for having, and I'm going to quote here, a fist full of crack. It was from the three strikes rule. Strike one. At the age of 19, Albert sold $20 worth of crack in New York, and he was sentenced to probation. Strike two. At the age of 22, Albert possessed 81 grams of crack in Charlotte, North Carolina, sentenced to 24 months in prison. Strike three. At the age of 24, Albert sold 193 grams of crack in South Carolina. And from what I've been told, I don't know this for a fact, but what I've been told, 193 grams of crack is like a fistful of crack. And he was sentenced to life in federal prison. Well, his lead counsel of Decarceration Collective, attorney Myangel Cody, who's going to join us shortly, she worked with attorney Brittany Barnett, and they worked to free him based upon the 2010 law that overturned the three strikes rule in terms of being in prison for certain amounts of crack cocaine. We're going to get into that. We're going to get into what does it mean to serve 25 years and be incarcerated. We're going to get into the ways in which we go against the system and how do we make a stand. We're going to do that this hour. So I want to start with Albert Reed Jr. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you for having me.
So now I want to be clear. You were just released on May 16th of this year.
Yes, yes, ma'am.
After serving 25 years, can you talk to us, one, about how you got there? Like, I kind of outlined strike one, strike two, strike three, but I know people have questions about how did you end up in that situation?
Well, the way I analyze it is I grew up in an environment that glamorized certain behavior, certain conduct, okay? And once I seen it as a youth, I just made it a part of me, in a sense. You know, my mother always preached education. You know, go to school, you can do better. But I was hard-headed. Mm-hmm. You know, my two sisters, they both got college degrees, you know, went to school. But I just liked that lifestyle. You know, we grew up without a father. You know, my father passed away when I was 7 years old, and, you know, that guidance that you need, you know, it's hard for a mother to raise a young man on her own, you know, especially when she's dealing with issues as well. You know, my mother, she was on heroin, you know. So I've seen a lot growing up that would make a average person look at life differently, you know. Like, I've seen people die from heroin, okay? It didn't stop me from selling it, but it stopped me from doing drugs, you know. I don't do drugs, never did drugs, but like I said, it didn't stop me from selling it. And like I said, I just grew fascinated from watching guys when I was a kid, because I played sports growing up, you know. I pretty much stayed busy. But when you're walking that walk, walking through the building, you see guys, you know, it just captured me, you know, captured my fascination, you know. And once my mother passed away at a certain, and when I was 16, you know, it was just like, I got to do something to help my family. So the plans that I had of going to school, I pretty much abandoned them. You know, I did wind up going to school at Denmark Technical College for a couple of years, you know, but really, after the first semester, it was like, this doesn't really interest me, you know.
Well, let me break in. So your mother was on heroin, you lost your father, and when your mother died, then in order to make money, to take care of your two sisters, you went into selling drugs to do that.
Yes.
Now, what was interesting to me is after strike one, when you were sentenced to probation, and then you had strike two. So strike one was in New York. Mm-hmm. Strike two was in Charlotte, North Carolina. So you were kind of traveling and doing drugs, because strike three was in South Carolina.
Yes.
Well, so there was never a thought between strike two and strike three that maybe that this lifestyle could lead to you ending up with 25 years in jail or life.
Well, we got to understand how the system works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after that first strike, they slap you on the wrist, give you probation. So now you're thinking, wow, you know, didn't that happen to me?
Okay.
You know, I got a lawyer, got some money, I got a lawyer, I can beat the case. You know, I'm not going to jail. So then you get caught up. You're still going back to the same environment, same friends, same thinking, same destructive mindset that would allow you to go back and do the same thing over and over again, thinking you're going to get a different result.
Now, when you came home, you told me, I was asking you, how has the adjustment been back home? And you said, mm-hmm, you have the support of your family.
Yes.
Because we know one of the things that we talk about is, how do we help formerly incarcerated residents kind of find their way back into their community?
Mm-hmm.
So what type of things would you suggest should be in place to keep people from getting into the system of recidivism, where they end up back on that track and find themselves back in jail?
Well, like, my situation is unique, because I don't have to worry about housing, mm-hmm, finding a house, paying rent, because my support system pretty much provides that for me. I don't have to worry about food, buying food at the moment, because my support system, my sisters, who I'm living with, my older sister, she provides that, you know. Clothing, when I got out, you know, the guys, mm-hmm, who I know, you know, who are doing positive things, they looked out for me, took me shopping. You know, my sister took me shopping, both of my sisters, so I didn't have to worry about that. You know, and these are the things that when a person comes out of prison that they need, you know, in order to go apply for a job, you know, in order to feel good about themselves. You know, so those programs that will allow us to house people coming out of prison, you know, provide some clothing so they can go on job interviews, you know, and get some food so that they don't have to worry about eating, you
right,
know what I mean?
Right.
The basic things that we all need, you know, in society.
Now, two of your childhood friends have been on our show before, and they're very well known here in Baltimore City. And so I'm joined now by Baltimore attorney Jason Rhodes. Jason, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
So you are a childhood friend of Mr. Reed's.
Not only a childhood friend, Albert used to live directly next to me in the project.
So then I guess the question that needs to be asked, right? So you grew up directly across the street. Both of you are in the projects. You are now a very well-known and successful Baltimore attorney, and Albert Reed is coming off a 25-year sentence. So I'm trying to figure out, what can we do to make sure that when we reach into the lives of young people who live in a situation the way you grew up and have them turn right rather than left? Like, what was the difference there?
Well, the difference for me, I mean, I think when I turned 8 years old, in my mind, for whatever reason, at 8 years old, I said, I want to get out of these projects, and the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to play basketball. So from that point on, I just had this laser focus on playing basketball. So anything that came in between that, I put that to the side. But what Al just said is super true. That lifestyle is very attractive because I remember around 82 when we were, like, I was 12, that's when things really started to take hold as far as the, you know, the drug selling. And my peers would have, you know, very nice cars, very nice everything. And it just, at that age, it takes a lot to turn away from that. You know, again, for me, basketball was my substitute. So I was allowed, I guess, to focus on that to the detriment of everything else.
Now, do you think in terms of using sports as a way to give young people that, what you said, that laser focus, does that mean that we need to pour more money into sports programs, into mentorship programs? Because we want to make sure that people, particularly young people right now, who, like Albert says, look at the lifestyles of people who are selling drugs on the street and that looks more attractive, that they actually see, like you did, that there are options for getting out.
Right. Yeah, I think now what a lot of people are pouring things into are like STEM programs, sports, anything that is geared towards children, which I think is necessary. I mean, when we grew up, we had a lot of positive male figures as far as coaches, and White Plains was literally a sports town where football was the big draw, and so basketball close second and track, you know, close third. So that environment kind of spoke to that, and people kind of looked towards that. But again, when 82 came, no one had ever seen crack before.
Right.
So this was something spanking new. So no one even knew how to deal with it. It appeared to be easy money. And, you know, of course, we see the results of that.
All right. Jason Rose, I want to say thank you so much for bringing us this story and just highlighting this for our attention. We appreciate you, sir.
All right. Thank you.
I also have Casey Jenkins, who is a restaurateur here in Baltimore City, is also a childhood friend of Mr. Reed's. Casey, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. And you know, this is an incredible show. And, you know, I'm just so proud of you, Al, that, you know, I can't express it enough.
Thank you.
Can you talk to us, Casey? Because one of the things we have, Mr. Rhodes was kind of sharing with us, how do we get young people to make different choices? I know that Mr. Reed is now talking about ways that we can motivate young brothers to make different decisions, but you're a childhood friend. Well, how did you make a different decision?
Well, you know, this is what I'd like to implore to the listening audience is that, you know, we grew up in White Plains, New York, and, you know, Al and Jason grew up as next-door neighbors, and I grew up across town. You know, whether or not the one thing that I loved about growing up in White Plains, New York, was that I don't care if your parents were, you know, in the back of a garbage truck, or whether or not they were a principal in a high school, or whether or not they were, you know, an attorney. You know, African Americans in the city of White Plains, they all stuck together, you know, and no matter what, if one child got all the children got, because we didn't believe, our parents didn't believe that just because you were not a person of color that you would not get the same, that you would get better, or that our children wouldn't get the same thing that they got. So what that did was that translated to us as adults. And so Al and I, you know, when I heard what he was going through, I wanted to be able to do whatever I could, because we all had that camaraderie and that kinship to one another growing up in White Plains. And it was a small African-American community in White Plains. So we wanted to make sure that we all looked out for one another and embraced one another. So moving forward, when he came home, you know, Jason and I and even my other partner, Marquise Walker, we all got together and let's say, you know, let's put our arms around Brother Al,
like,
because we love him. We love him.
I like that, because that is the way that we add that support. Casey Jenkins, as always, thank you so much. He's a big fan and supporter of the show.
God bless, and I love you all.
Love you too. So, folks, we're joined now to just kind of continue this conversation with attorney My Angel Cody. Along with attorney Brittany Barnett, she is making history by freeing more than 30-plus prisoners and counting who've been sentenced to life in federal prison without the possibility of parole for nonviolent drug offenses, which includes 6 presidential clemencies. My Angel Cody, how are you?
I'm well. I'm blessed. I'm abundant. I'm happy to be here and happy to participate in the conversation. Thank you for having me.
We're just so blessed to have you. So I want to have you, before I go back in the conversation with Mr. Reed, I want to have you talk to us about the way the law is set up, because I know that you worked to get Mr. Reed out of prison after 25 years on a life sentence because of the ways in which the laws were overturned. Can you talk to us about what law was overturned and how you were able to use that so that Mr. Reed can, you know, actually be sitting here with me today?
Sure, absolutely. I think, you know, going back to something that probably all of your listeners will recall is the death of Lynn Bias, the Maryland basketball standout, who died of a cocaine overdose. And that triggered, in 1986, this hysteria to get the war on drugs back ramped up, to put people in prison, and it started this 100-to-1 disparity between punishments for crack and powder cocaine, right? The reason why that's important is because even though Lynn Bias died of a cocaine overdose, his death triggered in Congress the war on black and brown people, and colloquially known as the war on drugs and the war on crack.
Right.
So what happened is people like Mr. Reed were serving mandatory life sentences under unfair crack penalties. President Obama signed a law in the place that reduced those penalties, right? So it lowered, it didn't completely erase, but it lowered the penalties between crack and powder and the disparity that we've seen that took so many black people in prison. Unfortunately, he couldn't get Congress to agree to retroactivity, so President Obama's signature changed the law going forward. In December, we had the First Step Act that made those changes retroactive. That removed the bar on the door to the courthouse so we could go back into court for people like Mr. Reed, petition to the court and say their sentence was unfair at the time that it was imposed, and it's grown even more unfair every year that they've been in human cages. Mm. Rehabilitating themselves, waking up every day with the audacity to face a life sentence, with survivorship, with contrition, with grace. And so for all those reasons, that's what we said to the court. People like Mr. Reed do not need to be in prison. They do not need to be permanently banished for a fistful of crack. Mm.
Now, if people are unfamiliar, I just want to let them know, Lynn Bias was a basketball player from the University of Maryland. And I remember when Lynn Bias died back in 1986, when everyone from D.C., because I'm from Washington, D.C., we were big Lynn Bias supporters in terms of the next stage of his life. So when you connect that to the way in which it became, quote, a war on drugs, which we know really became a war against, you know, economically challenged black folks, is what ended up happening, and the ways in which it gutted our community. Ms. Cody, can you talk about what can be done now? So if you're someone or a family member who was like Mr. Reed, where they're still incarcerated, and you're talking fistful of crack or marijuana charges, which at this point, everybody who's in jail for that should be free because of the new cannabis laws, but what should they look to do? Like, how do you fight this system?
Right. So I think that's a great question, and I want to pick up on something that you were asking the prior listeners, and that is, how do we get children like Mr. Reed to make better decisions? I think first we should understand that Mr. Reed, like so many of my clients and so many of the people who I stand with and fight for, were affected by the drug epidemic before they ever perpetuated it. So what Mr. Reed shared with the listeners is that his mother was addicted to heroin, right? And
right.
So oftentimes you have young people who are teenagers, under the age of 10 years old, who are affected by parental addiction, right? And there are a whole host of systems that have failed them before the United States government ever comes in and pays focused attention to them, right? So Albert Reed had a parent who suffered from a drug addiction. His father died before he reached the age of 10. His mother died before he reached the age of majority. So not only has he been affected by parental addiction, he's now concussed with the grief of having two parents who had passed away before he turned 18, right?
Right.
So I think the first thing we have to realize is that we have young people who are affected by trauma, who don't get grief counseling, who don't get any post-traumatic stress counseling, who are then making decisions that affect their entire lives, right? And no one's wondering, well, what happened to Mr. Reed? Who's going to take care of him, you know, or his sister, when both of his parents have died and their children, they're minors? So I think the first thing is recognizing that there are systemic failures that happen before people enter the criminal justice system, right? And then what happens is the criminal justice system is waiting. It's a trap. And like Mr. Reed said, you get probation, you get state court. And I have case after case where the person possesses a $10 bag of cocaine. They get probation. They cop out to a plea. Maybe the cop planted it on them. Maybe the cop didn't. But they cop out because they're tired of sitting in the county jail, right? So that's their first strike. And no one is telling them, you know, that's your first strike. If you have two more, then you're going to get a mandatory life sentence. So the system is set up to designed to keep people uninformed about the consequences of a plea in state court. Even if you got probation, even if it was a state court conviction, even if you only play because you need to get back to work. So I think that two things, recognizing that there are systemic failures that happen to people, particularly at a young age, that affects them and affects their judgment impairment. And then second, recognizing the flip side of that is that the criminal justice system or the criminal judicial system is prepared to pay attention to them where other systems have failed.
Well, folks, we are going to continue this conversation because I want to talk to Mr. Reed when we come back from the break. Mr. Reed says, you can lock my body, but you can't lock my mind. I want to get an insight into what the last 25 years have been like. We talk about, you know, the mass industrial prison complex. We talk about trying to keep people out of the system. We talk about what do you do when you're getting out of the system. But what has happened over the last 25 years, and where do we go from here? And we'll also continue with Ms. MyAngelo, attorney MyAngelo Cody. This is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Stay with us. Welcome back to Dr. K, Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Wyatt. Folks, according to the Buried Alive Project website, that's Ms. MyAngelo Cody's website, of the approximately 183,000 people in federal prison today, 46.2% of them are there for drug offenses. And approximately 3,800 men and women are serving life without parole. Among those serving life without parole sentences, almost half, about 49.1%, have been convicted of a drug crime. And get this, folks, 80% of them are people of color. The system is not broken. It is working exactly the way it was designed to work. And that means it was set up to, in a sense, imprison, oppress, and violently keep down black people and brown people in this country. It's not broken. It's working, folks. Before I start our conversation with attorney MyAngelo Cody and Mr. Albert Reed, I want to play a clip from the Third Strike documentary to open up our conversation.
I just say, how he gonna get life? He ain't murder no one. People that murder people don't even get life.
Many people don't realize that parole in the federal system was abolished in the 1980s. Right during the height of the war on drugs. So when a judge looks at you and says that you receive a life sentence, that means you will die in prison.
I've got a case where the man walked up to a parked car, shot the victim in the face, and he got 6 years in prison. So 6 years in prison for shooting a man in the face, as opposed to life in prison for having three drug charges. It just doesn't seem to balance out there.
We have 5,000 prisoners sitting in federal prison, and all I've asked, allow them as individuals to petition so that their sentences could be considered. That's something you've opposed. So in fairness, tell me why you still oppose that.
The justice system as it stands now is biased against the poor, against drug addicted, and against people of color.
Every prison I go to, I ask wardens, you know, these are the people in charge. I always say to them, are there people that don't belong here?
President Bill Clinton's crime bill, which was authored, just want to make sure folks are sitting down, by your Uncle Joe Biden, passed in 1994. If you take a look at the data that has been laid out here, I just want to put two things on the table, and then I want to come to Mr. Reed. Today, black people are nearly four times as likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than their white counterparts, particularly in occupied black and brown communities that are blatantly targeted for the broken windows policing and surveying. And we know what the broken windows theory is, folks. It's this idea that, you know, start off with a sociologist study, you put a car into a community. If the windows aren't broken, nobody touches the car. The minute you break the windows, all of a sudden the cars end up stripped. If you have a house, if you keep the windows fixed, it will stop crime to that house. So the broken windows theory is a way of taking black folks in, getting them in the system for quality of life crimes, which end up with what you were talking about, Mr. Reed, the three strikes rule. The first strike is a slap on the hand. And each time after that is to get you where you end up serving life for, you're talking a handful of crack. So, Mr. Reed, can you talk to us about the last 25 years? Like, not day by day, but what was it like? What kept you going in that situation?
What kept me going was the love of family. You know, when I walked in those doors, you know, it was a shock, basically, you know, because you're thinking that, okay, the guards are here to protect you. You know, everything's running smooth. But the violence, the ignorance, and the chaos that comes along with that is shocking. But what kept me is the fact that I said to myself, I'm not adapting to this. There's no way I can adapt to this and be able to survive. You know, and I was watching a video one day with Dr. Francis Cress Welsing.
Yes.
Okay. And I said to myself, that's the type of woman I want in my life, okay? But right now, I'm a mental midget. You know, she would chop you up and bitch you out, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I asked my sister to start sending me some books on history so I can reinforce who I am, you know what I mean? Who, rather, I didn't learn this in school, okay? So I need to know about us. We were never taught about us in school, you know, to instill that self-esteem that a lot of young children need these days, okay? And from doing that, like I say, I learned a lot about black people in general, you know, the history of black folk in this country and over in Africa.
Now, Attorney Cody, I want to come back to you. And folks, I do want to open up the lines. 410-319-8888. Perhaps you have questions for Mr. Reed or for Attorney Myangel Cody. She was featured in Essence Magazine, her and her partner. The work that they have done, one of her clients is Alice Johnson. That's the grandmother who served more than 20 years in prison for a first-time nonviolent offense. Now, everyone was all talking about the Kim Kardashian and all her work. Folks, come on now, we got to talk about who is behind the work and making sure that we cite the black women who are doing this work and that we give them credit for that. So, Attorney Cody, can you talk to us about the ways in which this system is designed to get black people and brown people into the prison system?
Sure. And I just want to say that Alice Johnson was my partner, Brittany Barnett's client. She'd been walking with her and flanking her for years.
Wow.
Before anybody got involved and anybody was using their platforms to bring her case to the national media. You know, and so I think you're right, just recognizing the survivorship of people in prison, but also the contributions of black women lawyers who are doing this work is so important, and
right.
I really appreciate you for saying that. And I, you know, what I will say is for people who are looking to get involved with the system or to understand how it works, it is, and I was a federal defender here in Chicago for almost a decade, and if you walk into a courtroom, In most courtrooms in America, in criminal courtrooms, you notice that the defendants are predominantly black and brown. There are
right.
some exceptions, but they're predominantly black and brown. The judges, courtroom staff, and others are predominantly not, right? And so I think most people can look at that situation and make two conclusions. A, you either think that we see black people disproportionately as defendants because, A, they're more likely to commit crime, which makes you a racist. Or you look at that scenario and you say, we see predominantly black people and brown people in the system because the system is targeting them, which makes the system racist, right? But either way we go, we can't take out of the equation the level of racism and erasure that happens of human stories, particularly right. Black stories, right? So I've stood in courtrooms arguing to judges that they should consider the history, the characteristics of the individual who they are tasked with sentencing. And you see time and again that it's sort of an erasure of that historiography, their human story, their story of struggle, their story of suffering, the fact that they may have had drug-addicted parents, the fact that they may have suffered some neglect. It starts with the erasure of the human being's story. And that, to me, is how the system is metabolizing off of Black and brown bodies, by erasing the experience that they had that brought them into the courtroom in the first place. And so for us to do this work, it is a reclamation of that story, because I always felt like if you're going to throw someone like Mr. Reed away, then you have to know who you threw away. You don't just get to throw people away and not care about who they are or not listen and struggle with the details of their life. So that's really, really important. And that's the what we've made the center of the work, is the human beings and the heartbeats and at the core of who we're throwing away. And another thing I would say is, you know, I'm very, very heartened to see our nation is paying attention to the family separations that are happening on the border.
Right. Yes. Yes.
But we ought to be very clear that America has been committing family separations for a very long time. And it started against Black and brown people.
Right.
Right. And so this is not a new phenomenon. This is not America finding a new apparatus to separate people from, you know, now we are talking about children being separated from their parents, but we've been separating parents from children for a very, very long time, as Mr. Reed can attest to, being separated from his daughter. So I think that understanding the nature of how the system is manifesting, this is not new. This is not new. But also I would say that what keeps me inspired is the fact that Mr. Reed survived 25 years of mandatory life sentence. And when I first spoke to him, that made me want to work harder to get him free, because I realized that people like him, they are our trust fund. They are our community trust fund.
Like that.
We are all richer with him back. It's not just about him having his freedom back or his daughter having her father back. We have Mr. Reed back.
Now, folks, I just want to just make a note very quickly before I go into answering your calls here. When you talk about the history of child separations, I would just urge you to go take a look at the New York Times. Dr. Tara Hunter from Princeton University did a wonderful piece in the New York Times called The Long History of Child Snatching that gives you some context to what Attorney Cody was just talking about. Now, I have so many questions, and I know we have calls. I'm going to come first to Donna, and then I want to come back because I'm trying to figure out how did Attorney Cody get onto Mr. Reed's case and the ways in which Mr. Reed's family life changed after his father died. We've got a lot of questions, but I want to get Donna from Baltimore. Donna, how are you?
Pretty good, Dr. K, and you know this is my favorite topic.
Oh, I know.
My favorite topic.
I know.
To both your guests, have you heard about the book called The Conspiracy to Destroy Black Women by Michael Porter? If you haven't,
yes,
please get that book. And I definitely support Mr. Reed's comments about Dr. Wellesley. That's what she opened my eyes when she had that chart that showed white supremacy and where we flow, how the chart just branched out into how we were being destroyed and how we ended up in the prison system and the social service system, et cetera. My question to both of you, and Dr. K knows I've asked this question before.
Yes.
Do you consider, two questions, do you consider poverty a trauma? That's one.
Mm-hmm.
And the second question is, do you think that the social service system has been deliberately set up to continuously destroy black women and our black children, which is why we're in the condition we're in today?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll hang up and I'll listen.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And so what I'm going to do, Attorney Cody, I'm going to pull out Donna's question. She calls a lot. She's one of our familiar callers. So I kind of have a handle on her questions. But the first one was this idea about trauma and poverty, which I want to go to Mr. Reed about. I know that your family, Mr. Reed, you were middle class before your dad died when you were 7 years old.
Yes.
And that financial hit that your family took is what moved your mom to move to a different community. So in terms of the trauma of just moving into a different community, going from middle class, dropping a class level, do you see poverty from your experience as a traumatic experience that actually should be dealt with in terms of counseling for Black and brown people?
Well, it can be. But I also know some people that were in poverty, and they used that as motivation to come up out of poverty and improve their lives. But for me, it was a shock.
Right.
You know, not to go on trips no more, you know, family outings like we used to, move from house to house before we landed in the projects, having to live with relatives and whatnot. You know, so that was, to me, something that I guess after thinking about it, because I never really thought about it in those terms, you know, it could be.
Attorney Cody, I want to come to you about the second question that Donna posed, where she says, do you believe that the social services system has been deliberately set up to destroy Black families?
I think that the social services system has been deliberately destabilized to destroy Black families. I think, I'm not sure that it's been set up properly with any due diligence in a very, very long time. And so, you know, I'm here in Chicago and Illinois, and I look at the defunding of many social services and wonder if that destabilization of those social services is part of an apparatus that leads to incarceration and the erosion of Black families. And so I agree with the core and the crux of her question. I think that the destabilization, the defunding, the underfunding, the underintentionality that we see in those social right. services is what is the problem.
And so then I want to come to you. How did you get wind? And I say this because from where I sit, Attorney Cody, it feels like there are hundreds of cases that could take your attention, right, in terms of the number of Black people who are in jail for the offenses that we're talking about, these low-level drug offenses. How did you get wind of Mr. Reed's case?
You know what, Dr. K, I would say this. We're not playing any games as Black women lawyers. Mm. We're not playing any games. We have a spreadsheet for everything.
Nice.
Because what we realize is that we have to be as prepared, more prepared than the system to extract people when the law changes and the time is right. So what we did was we sent out hundreds, if not thousands, of questionnaires to people in federal prison. Mr. Reed received one, returned it, and we were trying to identify who had a life sentence, what was the basis for their life sentence, what drug was involved, how much of the drug was involved. And so we set up a database to track cases so that when the law changed, that we would be ready to file motions immediately for people that we believe were eligible. And so part of what this work is rapid response, it's constant triage, because we are in a state of crisis within the Black community. So, and by crisis, I mean we are in a state of having to extract people who are buried alive as quickly as possible, because we realize that every day that they're in prison matters, every moment they're in prison matters.
Right.
So we had Mr. Reed's survey and his responses for a long time, and then when the law changed, we went through and identified people that we thought we could fight for in prison. And, you know, so part of it is really intentional and systematic, and part of it is really organic, because you know, I also had to ask Mr. Reed if I could represent him and fight for him and get his permission to do that, which is not something I take lightly either.
So, Mr. Reed, can you talk about Albert Reed and Associates? I know that you're now doing consulting and professional services, because I know people are interested in, like, what's next for you?
Yes, I'm looking to work with Albert Reed and Associates. We're looking to network with other organizations that are like-minded. You know, we're trying to work towards a better tomorrow for those in need. You know, ex-offenders is really our target right now at the moment, you know. But for me, I also want to set up a mentorship program, because I know how that's important that is to the young people, you know, growing up today, you know, like I was back then, watching certain things, seeing certain things, and understanding how that can affect them to make choices that are not beneficial to them. So I'm also in the process of setting that up right now, a mentorship program, and hopefully use some ex-offenders who have actually came out and established their own businesses, you know, or have landed you know, jobs in respectable professions, you know.
Well, you know what, Dr. K,
yes,
to add to that, that's really what liberation work is about for myself, for the Decarceration Collective. And it's not just about getting people out of prison, right? Yeah, we've saved 38, 39 lives, right, who served a collective 700-plus years in prison. But if you look at, like, the work that these guys and these women have done once they've gotten out, then you really see the true value of the work. It's decarcerating people. It's rebuilding communities. It's unlocking talent. It's not just unlocking people, but unlocking their potential and their talent as well.
Well, let me ask you, because I'm looking at, you know, the Essence magazine article with your partner, and I want to just kind of hone in on one thing that Attorney Barnett said, that Black women are the fastest growing prison population. Can you talk about what exactly does this mean in terms of the numbers in comparison to Black men, comparison to white women across the board, and why do you think this is happening?
I think that what it is misogynoir. Mm-hmm. It is an anti-Blackness that particularly is an anti-Blackness against Black women, our contributions, our strengths, our resilience, our survivorship. I think once we realize that the system is too often weaponized against us in ways that puts us in cages, it starts out in eroding our economic stability. So you might get a ticket, you might have a broken taillight, you get pulled over, you get fined, you can't pay the fine, then you're sitting in county jail. It's slow erosion of dignity and liberty that I think Black women experience too often, that we just see too often. And so that's what I think is the core of it. And then it escalates to, you know, larger offense of convictions or charges. Often I see in my own practice, I've seen Black women who were charged as a way to get at someone else. Maybe they have a boyfriend in a drug case, et cetera. So the government isn't really interested in punishing that person, that woman. The government is interested in using her freedom and threatening to take away her freedom in order to get another person, right? And so that's where we can realize the system really isn't about public safety as it often says it is, though it has really good marketing. It's really about numbers and cases closed and statistics. And all too often, I've stood with Black women in court and known that the pathology of the system isn't designed to make any of us feel safer by locking her up, right? It's about closing cases. It's about making sure that we have a number of agents who are funded, a task force, that we're all sort of lawyers who are getting paid somehow by the system, and we're all paying our mortgages off of the encaging of Black bodies, and more often than we've ever experienced of the caging of Black women's bodies.
But in a system where there's a lot of overcriminalization, which we deal with when it comes to Black and brown people, what are some of the ways that you think that Black people in the moment can stand up against this?
I think, number one, serve on jury.
Okay.
I cannot say that enough. There have been so many times where I've had a federal trial and I've had jury panels of potential jury members and wish that more Black people would serve on the jury, would not try to get out of jury service. And I wish the people who served on juries understood that a verdict for people like Albert Reed means a life sentence. Even though you're told you can't consider, you're not supposed to consider the sentence. So people, we have to wake up and realize when you're returning a verdict of guilty, you're sending someone like Albert Reed to permanent banishment. And so I would say number one is to serve on juries. I would say number two is to know the state court judges that you're voting for at the polls. I'm a lawyer, and sometimes I'm like, because I don't practice in state court, I'm like, I don't know who this person is. And so I'm trying to figure out, you know, based on whether the name sounds appropriately ethnic, I don't know, like, if I'm going to vote for the person. And so I would say, we need to understand who are these judges who are sitting in state court, because that's also very important. Those are ways that ordinary people, your ordinary listeners, can get involved and drive change in the system.
I definitely can appreciate that. I know, Mr. Reed, that one of the problems that people have is reconnecting back with their community. And yes. You've talked about how that's not really an issue for you because you have the support of your family. We've heard from your friends, Casey Jenkins and Jason Rhodes, who are you know, have very strong relationships with you. But if someone doesn't have that, so they come home and they don't have a family, a sister waiting for them to feed them, to clothe them, to house them, but they get out and they are on their own, what do you suggest that they do so that they don't end up back in the system?
Well, I've encountered a lot of guys that got out of the system or were on their way out, but they didn't have the mindset. They waited to the last second to figure out what it is I'm going to do.
Okay.
Okay. It starts while you're in there. You have to prepare yourself for getting out. You know, the other day I was sitting, going through some boxes of stuff that came from prison, and I came across my articles of incorporation, okay, for Albert Reed and Associates. And I had wrote that in like 2008, you know, so you have to start while you're in there. And then when you come out, you know, you have a plan.
Right.
You have a plan. And then you have maybe get in a situation where organizations can come together and give you that roadmap as to how to put your life back together if you don't have it already figured out. You know, like a lot of guys don't already have it figured out when they are on their way out. You know, and they need help in doing that. So with Albert Reed and Associates, we want to do that. We want to serve the community through outreach and community development, you know, so that when guys do get out, we can offer them some direction as to what they need to do in order to be successful and stay out of prison. Change that mindset.
When we talk about that, Attorney Cody, in terms of staying out of prison, in terms of trying to find and have a roadmap and a plan, what are some of the things that you do as an attorney? I know you come in to get them out, right, to get them free. But I know that you and Attorney Barnett also talk about wanting to see formerly incarcerated residents. You want to see them flourish as well.
Sure. Right. You know, and I think that's how the work remains for me, spiritual work. It's not, I don't just see Mr. Reed or anyone as just a client because, you know, what it is showing up for people and standing with people even after they're released. We have paid for flights home after prison. We have given people grants to start their own businesses because that's really what the work requires. Sometimes it requires helping someone pay parking tickets that are 20 years old because they've been in prison for 20 years and they can't get a driver's license in order to get to a job interview because right. They have unpaid parking tickets. It's the details. It's finding housing for people. It's writing letters of recommendation. I would tell you that any of your viewers, if you have a company or a business or you know someone hiring, then it's certainly, that's a place where people can show up, writing letters of recommendation. We've created right. awards like the Decarceration Collective's Reentry Award. It's all the things that any of us needs in order to make it. We need some accolades. We need some accommodation. We need shelter. We need a way to navigate the system in order to get our identification. All of those things are important. And that's really what the work for us as Black women lawyers is. It's what the moment requires. It's what we will do. We will scratch concrete to get you out.
Right.
And then you stomp on dirt until you are settled.
You know, it's interesting, Attorney Cody, because I was reading a study that talks about, you know, for people who are economically challenged, it's actually expensive to get a job. Because once you get a job, you're talking about health care, you're talking about money to get to the job, you're talking about trying to have clothes. Like just the cost of getting a job is sometimes so overwhelming.
Yes, yes. It's daunting. It's daunting. But I would say that having stood behind the curtain at the Wizard of Oz for a very long time, I am so inspired by the guys that I represent. Because they make every, when you stand with 38 people who've given back life sentences, it's hard for you to feel like anything is too daunting that you can't
right.
overcome.
You
right. know, and so we are abundantly supplied to do this.
And you're doing some incredible work. Attorney Maya Angelou Cody, we just appreciate you coming on. We also want to say, just on behalf of all the people that you have helped, and the ways in which you and your partner have done the 90 Days of Freedom campaign, the ways in which you're speaking up and speaking for people to have their lives restored to them. We just appreciate you and we thank you.
Absolutely. And if I could just center the names of the clients that we're currently
please.
In prison, Stephen Moscano, Troy Lawrence, Perry Malone, Alto Parnell. They're all featured on the Third Strike Campaign's website. It's www.thirdstrikecampaign.com. Those are the next ones that we're fighting for. We're coming for you.
I like that. Oh, I love the way you said that. Thank you so much, Attorney My Angel Cody. Mr. Albert Reed, who got out just in May of this year after 25 years. He was originally sentenced to life in prison. They said he was going to be buried alive, folks. And here he is sitting now. Thank you so much, Mr. Reed. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So, folks, I want to leave it here for just a moment. Make an appointment. Meet me back here tomorrow at 3 because I want to have another conversation about what does it mean to fight to make this country better. Angela Davis said it best. I am no longer accepting the things I cannot change. I am changing the things I cannot accept. Folks, I'm leaving the challenge at your feet. I'm throwing down the gauntlet. Let's talk about change and challenge and protest tomorrow. This is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Keep it here for the culture. Instead of Faraji Muhammad, who's off busy doing things, we have Anthony McCarthy sitting in the chair. It's been an honor and a privilege. I look forward to tomorrow.